this is really a human right to feel safe in your workplace, whether you work at Fox or you work at CNN or you work in Hollywood or you work at a bank.
In the new movie Bombshell, producer and star Charlize Theron tells the story of the unlikely group of women at Fox News who brought down its founder, Roger Ailes. And Matrix filmmaker Lily Wachowski came out as trans in 2016. Now she's a producer on the new series, Work in Progress.
We have a lot of trans people proliferating the background and supporting cast. So that part felt extremely gratifying.
Also, a new podcast makes the case for why Dolly Parton might be the great unifier in our fractured country. It's The Frame Weekend from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. I'm John Horn. We'll be right back. Welcome to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. On this show, we talk with creative people about how and why they do what they do and about how their art is shaped by the wider world. Later today, the choreographer Matthew Bourne. He turned the dance world upside down in 1995 when he created a swan lake with male swans. Nearly 25 years later, the piece remains revolutionary, but also incredibly emotional. But we're going to start today with Charlize Theron. She's the star and producer of the upcoming movie Bombshell. Theron plays Megyn Kelly in the film in her time at Fox News and later with a very brief stint on the Today Show on NBC. Kelly came under fire more than once for some controversial comments.
Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa, you know? And by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white, but this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, you know, Santa is what he is, and just so you know, we're just debating this.
The movie Bombshell focuses not only on Kelly, but also on other women at the network, including former Fox News host Gretchen Carlson. She sued Fox News head Roger Ailes for sexual harassment, but she wasn't alone. Ailes harassed a number of women at the network. Bombshell was nominated for 4 SAG Awards this week, including Best Ensemble. The cast includes Nicole Kidman and Margot Robbie. I talked to Charlize Theron the morning that the SAG nominations came out.
I want to be cool and talk like, you know, I'm just so not affected by any of this stuff. But it was pretty fascinating and it was really great. It was a great moment. This film only exists because of the ensemble.
How would you describe what this movie is about?
It's a movie about a group of very unlikely women who, if you were, you know, writing a fictional story, you would not necessarily cast as your central characters to tell a story of taking down the biggest media mogul. And yet they did.
Why were they unlikely, do you think?
Well, because I think a lot of them, you know, Gretchen and Megan had made some comments prior to all of this about sexual harassment that I found not necessarily helpful to the cause of a lot of, you know, women who were experiencing sexual harassment. I think there is a conservative view on sexual harassment as how do you believe women? How do you know it's true? The emphasis is always on doubting the victim, doubting the woman. And I just thought it was interesting that they had those views before in the past about sexual harassment. Megyn Kelly famously refuses to be called a feminist. You know, they are somewhat the most unlikely feminist that you will find.
No, and Megyn Kelly had said some very problematic things about campus assaults and whether or not the men were not believed and that the women were believed too easily, I guess, is a harsh but I think fair way to paraphrase her position.
Yes.
When you read Charles Randolph's script for Bombshell, what was your reaction and what was going on in your professional career when you came across it?
You know, I was, we had a lot of things at Denver and Delilah, my production company, in development. And very strangely, we were in development on a project with Jay Roach, who ended up directing Bombshell. And we read it and just, we really loved it. I mean, you have to understand, the script was written pre-Time's Up, pre-Harvey Weinstein. there wasn't any of what is out there right now in our culture as far as this conversation. It felt somewhat like a story in its own silo. But people were definitely kind of whispering about a lot of what was about to come out. And so you could feel it. You could feel there was like this kind of like under like this bubbling that was happening and the pot was about to boil over. We definitely felt that. And so when we read the script, we were aware a little bit of, I mean, nobody could predict how big all of this would be, but we were aware that there was something timely about the script.
It's like we're telling women, go on, speak up for yourself. Just know the entire network is with Roger. No one will believe you. They'll call you a liar. Oh, and as for your career, you want assignments and airtime? Go ahead. Call the paranoid man who decides your salary a pervert and do that on a f***ing anonymous hotline he controls. On a phone, he has a contractual right to record. Jesus f***ing Christ, do you think women are idiots?
We're talking with Charlize Theron, who is an actor in and producer of the new movie Bombshell. Was there a point where you felt you found something from inside you as an actor that connected you on some level to Megyn Kelly that wasn't part of her physical appearance?
Yeah, I mean, listen, when we started, I never, ever thought I would ever say I have that much in common with Megyn Kelly. We have different point of views on a lot of things, so we'll just leave it at that. But I, through research, started realizing that she was talking about a lot of things that I could relate to as a woman in my industry. You know, we definitely live in a world where men are rewarded and applauded for being ambitious and for being powerful and for having drive and for not taking no as an answer and sometimes being the not nice person in the room because that's the right thing to do and it's right for the company and it's right for your business. And when women tend to have those qualities, they very easily can be turned around and weaponized against you or turned around into a negative. And
right, a man is driven, a woman's a bitch.
Yep, there you go. So that's where I think I emotionally tapped in to this part. Megyn Kelly was part of something that was just really kind of mind-blowing that happened at Fox. But the everyday going to work, the process, the being called a bitch when you're just trying to be the best at your job, all of those things felt very familiar to me. As a woman, I related to those things. And I could empathize with a woman like that, being in a position that she found herself in, having to struggle with the idea of coming forward and losing all of that.
And is that, to you, the clearest line between what happened to Megyn Kelly, what happens to actresses in Hollywood, the difference between Roger Ailes and Harvey Weinstein? Where do you see the most direct link between what's in this movie and what's in show business?
Oh, it's all a direct link. I mean, I feel like this issue does not, you know, it doesn't behave or look different in different places just because of the industry. It is a nonpartisan issue. This is really a human right to feel safe in your workplace, whether you work at Fox or you work at CNN or you work in Hollywood or you work at a bank in Minnesota or a mine in Minnesota. This is a human right that we should all have.
Charlize, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Charlize Theron stars in and is a producer on Bombshell. It opens in theaters on December 20th. You're listening to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. As we mentioned in the conversation with Charlize Theron, Hollywood's award season is in full swing. And joining me to talk about the SAG nominations and what comes next is Kyle Buchanan. He is the Carpetbagger Awards columnist at the New York Times. Kyle, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
So let's start first with the SAG Awards. They are important because the Academy's largest voting bloc is actors, and the SAG Awards, Screen Actors Guild, is actors. How much overlap is there historically?
A lot, as opposed to a lot of the organizations that have weighed in so far, like, you know, your dreaded Golden Globes, John.
We don't talk about them.
But we can in contrast, which is they're about 90 eccentric voters, And the SAG committee is, I think it's something like 2,000 chosen at random, and then it's voted on by many thousands more. That is a sort of more accurate simulation of what you're going to find with the Academy, which is several thousand people. And like you said, actors are the biggest body. So what you'll find is whoever SAG nominates, I'd say probably about 4 out of 5 of those people at the least are going to get nominated for an Oscar as well.
So the SAG Awards have an equivalent of the Best Picture competition. It's called Best Ensemble.
The nominees for Outstanding Performance by a Cast in a Motion Picture are Bombshell, The Irishman, Jojo Rabbit, Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, and Parasite.
When you look at what's in and what's out, what are the main takeaways here?
The biggest one for me is that I don't think anybody expected Parasite would get in here. Parasite, you know, obviously the foreign language sensation of the season, directed by Bong Joon-ho. It's this really fantastic Palme d'Or winning South Korean. Well, even to describe the genre would be to spoil
I don't know how you
bit.
Would describe it.
But this is a movie that is going to be in the Oscar race in a major way, probably picture, director, screenplay. But the thing I didn't expect is for it to get any acting nominations. That's a tricky thing. If you want to win Best Picture, you really have to have an acting nomination somewhere. You know, for Parasite to win, then it would be overcoming two big debits, which are no acting nomination and no foreign language film has won before.
The other thing that I thought was really surprising, given that it is an ensemble film, is Little Women. I love this movie. I thought it was a really good adaptation by Greta Gerwig. Great performances all around, and yet it didn't seem to stick with SAG voters.
Yeah, Little Women isn't really having a great awards run so far. I mean, we should note the movie is not out yet. You know, its fortunes could turn around, especially if it becomes a big box office hit. Helps to have that wind in your sails. But yeah, the Golden Globes and SAG kind of gave it the cold shoulder. SAG most of all. It was snubbed across the board. Even Saoirse Ronan didn't get in.
The other thing that I think has been noteworthy is there are certain actors who have been really working hard. I mean, some actors don't like to do this. And I think of Anthony Hopkins from Two Popes being somebody who doesn't really want to campaign. And then you have somebody like Taron Egerton from Rocket Man. Either he likes it or he's not complaining about doing it. And it does feel like that part of the campaigning is starting to have results for people who are all in.
I've seen Taron Egerton at more awards events than I've seen my parents in the last few months. He is out there working it very good-naturedly, and he's up against a field of men who don't want to schmooze. He's up against people like Adam Driver, Joaquin Phoenix, Christian Bale. These people are not teddy bears.
And the other thing that I think is important is that he is in a movie that's not getting a lot of attention outside of his performance. Mm-hmm. And there is a woman who is, I think, probably the presumptive favorite for Best Actress in a very similar situation, and that is Renee Zellweger from Judy.
We're kind of back to the dark ages when it comes to Best Actress performances. Recent history, maybe the last 2 or 3 years aside, there had been sort of a troubling trend where the nominees for Best Actress did not front Best Picture nominees, you know, which is an indication that I think Oscar voters and maybe Hollywood tend to prioritize or assign more weight to stories fronted by men. And boy, is that true this year when you have things like Irishman, when you have things like Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. It's very likely that all the nominees, save for Scarlett Johansson and Marriage Story in Best Actress, are going to be from films left out of the Best Picture conversation.
We're talking with Kyle Buchanan from the New York Times about the Screen Actors Guild Awards. We may not agree about whether or not the last 3 Best Picture winners were deserving, Green Book, Shape of Water, and Moonlight, but I will make an argument that they have something in common. These are all stories about marginalized people, people who have been cast aside. And this is why my argument is going to be that the movie that I said when I saw it the first time, I really thought had a chance to win Best Picture is Jojo Rabbit.
That's not where I thought you'd go with this. I'm excited.
I don't know where you thought I was going to go. But I do think that part of what any awards organization is doing is responding to how they see a film fitting into a larger conversation. This is a movie about somebody who is taught to be hateful and he learns to be accepting. And even though it's a comedy, the Academy historically doesn't like comedies in its Best Picture race. I can make the argument that Jojo Rabbit is the movie for right now.
Even more than a comedy, it's a satire. How often do you see a satire win Best Picture, let alone one directed by the director of Thor Ragnarok? We'll see. You know, as you were delivering all that preamble, John, I thought you might end by saying Parasite. The Academy is diversifying itself, and foreign language films are going to have to win Best Picture at some point. You know, if one is going to win, I think that this movie, which is so fast and fluid, and which feels so contemporary and so easily transposed to the current American class struggle, more and more, especially after what happened with SAG this week, I think Parasite could be the first foreign language film to win Best Picture.
Kyle Buchanan is the Carpetbagger columnist at the New York Times. Kyle, great to see you. Thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
After a short break, Abby McEnany is the star and co-creator of the new Showtime series Work in Progress. She joins me along with the show's executive producer, Lily Wachowski. That's next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. In the first episode of the new Showtime series, Work in Progress, the main character, played by Abby McEnany, confronts her nemesis, former Saturday Night Live cast member Julia Sweeney.
Yeah, you should go tell her that she ruined your life. Get it over with and be done.
How do you see that going? Like, hi, Miss Sweeney, my name is Abby. Your character, Pat, that you played, who nobody could tell was a man or a woman, ruined my life. Have a good night.
Wait, what?
Yeah, that was the only joke of the whole premise.
Work in Progress tells the story of a gender nonconforming woman in Chicago. Abby co-created it with director Tim Mason. Their executive producer and fellow writer is Lily Wachowski. Is this Abby and Lily?
Yes.
Yes.
Is this
you might know Wachowski as the co-writer and co-director of the Matrix movies. Lily came out as a trans woman in 2016. Abby, any filmmaker or actor who takes a project anywhere, you know, knows that they are presenting something of theirs. But does it feel as if when you show that first pilot, in some ways it's almost like a referendum on whether or not your life is interesting and important to other people?
Well, now it does. I'm thinking about all those people who said no. Gosh darn it. I have to say one thing about having the pilot being so much in my voice, and it's really me up there being messy and, like, you know, screeching and being awkward, that, like, I was weirdly confident in those meetings in LA. And what I would say, I wasn't confident, but I was way more confident than I would have been because I didn't have to pretend to be anybody else, right? Like, mm-hmm. I'm in these LA meetings. They know I'm this messy kind of verbal vomiter who's, like, trying to figure stuff out. And it gave me, a level of confidence that I hadn't had before. Again, it wasn't huge, but it was better than it was. And then also to go in with Lily Wachowski by your side makes you feel pretty good, too.
Slick Lily Wachowski.
I know. So, like, yeah, you got the dirty Abby over here. You got slick Lily over here. Yeah.
The thing that's, like, cool to me is that the show is, like, extremely honest. And, you know, you ask Abby about, you know, what was it like to put yourself out there like that. You can really feel how honest the show is. And I think, like, that's, like, one of the things that Abby had been doing for so long with her one-woman shows was putting herself out there in, you know, these sort of crystallized versions of what this show is. And so it spoke to me in terms of, like, you know, mental health and depression and being a queer person, and a show that embodies, like, you know, people who don't get to have a voice on television.
What you're saying, Lily, is, if I'm hearing it right, is that, yes, this is Abby's story, but this is our story.
Well, it's really my story is what I'm trying to say. yes, there is an hourness to it. There is, like, a big queer part of the story that is, like, super important to me. Like, bringing as many queer people as we could onto the show and our casting. There's a lot of transness in the show besides Theo, who plays Chris.
Can I buy you a drink sometime?
Really? Yeah, actually, I'd love it. I haven't been out for a drink with an attractive woman in a really long time, so.
Actually, I'm a trans man.
Well, I haven't been out with an attractive trans man in ever, so.
The show is extremely subversive in its casting because we have a lot of trans people proliferating the background and supporting cast, like characters who will give like one or two lines, just trans people, something that you see in everyday life, but you don't see represented on television. So that part was like, felt extremely gratifying to do something that I hadn't necessarily done in my career, you know, being a closeted trans person for so long.
We're talking with Abby McEnany and Lily Wachowski about the series Work in Progress. Well, the other thing, Lily, you hadn't really done is something as funny as this. Obviously, you worked on some series with Sense8 on Netflix. You've done the Matrix franchise. How would you say you adapted to the idea of comedy, and what were you learning along the way about what is and is not funny?
I was just biding my time is what I was really doing. I was auditioning for the comedy scene with all of those side projects. I don't know. It's, you know, filmmaking is about timing. And, you know, a kung fu fight is about timing. And action sequences are about timing. And all of the films that I've been a part of are like genre movies, and they all are about pace. And like, you know, you want to make sure that things are moving along. And so I don't necessarily think that you can compartmentalize comedy and something like The Matrix or Bound. I mean, all of those things are like, you know, I think they're all integrated in a way. And, you know, this show isn't just a comedy. To call this show a comedy and only a comedy sells the show short because there's so much more going on in it. It's really about this human experience, but, you know, a specific queer experience. And so, I don't know. I don't know. I think that's a really good line.
In fact, it brings up a clip I wanted to play, and this is one
of the segue, Wachowsk.
This is one of the early episodes, and it's funny, but it's about a serious issue, which is what is it like to use a public restroom as someone who's gender nonconforming?
That woman over there just gave me that whole "Are you in the right bathroom?" look.
It still happens.
Yeah, Allie, it still happens.
Well, I didn't think that it would happen here.
What are you talking about? It happens everywhere. It's happened to me in gay bars.
What? Come on.
I'm serious. Every single time I go into a public bathroom, I feel unsafe. I even did my, "Hi, how are you?" voice, you know, so she could know that I'm
Julia Child.
A lady. I'm a lady.
Oh, okay. Abby, people are ignorant.
All those experiences that we show, I mean, they're all real. And I think it is important to share that. I think we just want to show a human story about struggles that most people don't have to think about. The fact that I'm 51 years old and I get nervous when I have to use a public bathroom, like, I think that's something people don't think about. And I think that, you know, leads to a lot of misunderstanding and a lot of impatience with queer folks or gender nonconforming folks who are living these struggles, and people really don't care that, like, they feel hindered in certain situations, that it's not easy.
You know, trans representation and queer representation, you're feeling like we've got our toe in the door and we're trying to wrestle that thing open, but you still feel the resistance, you still feel the pushback by the industry that wants to continue to rely on these lazy ass stereotypes. It's disheartening, but, you know, we're still here and we're still fighting away.
Lily Wachowski is the co-writer and executive producer of Work in Progress. Abby McEnany is the co-creator, writer, star, and executive producer of the series. Lily and Abby, thanks so much for coming on the show. It's great to talk about the series.
John, it was so fun to talk to you again.
Thanks,
thank you very
John.
Much.
Work in Progress is on Showtime. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. If you type the words Good Morning Band into an internet search engine, you're going to find an endless number of morning news shows with bands performing on them. But what you won't find is the Australian indie rock duo called Good Morning. And yet, despite having no significant press attention in the United States, they've somehow managed to get millions of plays on Spotify, many by fans on the West Coast. Last month, they played multiple sold-out shows in Los Angeles during their first U.S. tour, and they even stopped at KPCC.
Hi, I'm Stefan from the band Good Morning.
And I'm Liam, also from the band Good Morning.
He looked at me, it's no surprise.
We met in high school in, must be 2010, I want to say. We hit it off pretty quickly. We had mutual friends. We knew each other sort of vaguely. Mm. And then I think there was a free dress day where you were wearing like a band t-shirt. There was probably some like smart ass comments, and that was probably the start of it. Shortly after that, we started writing songs and sending each other demos, just for fun, really. Eventually, one day, we thought it'd be a good idea to put out a record of some of those songs, and it has pretty much just escalated from there.
Toothpaste and breakfast, and a check to see we're all alive.
I think the way we've been able to get to America has been just organically, or yeah, whatever the 2019 version of organically is, just through
people,
the internet.
People sharing music.
There is this strange thing where, with this like Spotify and YouTube and stuff, you can see, especially West Coast America, I don't know what it is about the West Coast, but
yeah,
we could see that people were listening to it here.
Yeah,
we just took our time to get here, I guess. I think that it's kind of our preferred method of working, mm, is to work quickly and
yeah,
have fun while we're doing it.
It'd be great to make something that's super polished, but I don't think we have the capabilities like on our own. So
yeah, I think I like the feeling of something that feels kind of like a first take, or
yeah,
that hasn't been labored over.
I thought I was winning. I thought I was winning.
Sub was actually written super quickly.
What is the cause of my submission? Is it in my past? Is it in my future? Or is it me?
I think it's just born out of a lot of like social anxiety, and like the idea of conversation and hanging out with people terrifies me.
Who needs a boy without a spine?
But I need to remember that I'm capable of it. It was sort of like a reminder to stick up for myself in a way. I just feel like I can be very submissive and just like will accept whatever's going on. But sometimes it's good to state your feelings and speak up for yourself and look after yourself in a way. Yeah,
it's important. So everyone needs a reminder on that sometimes.
Everybody. Yeah.
Coming in hot, right off the top. I may as well crash into you. You are the best supporting actor.
Best supporting actor is a love song about my boyfriend. One of the first Good Morning love songs. It's been a recent development that we now have love songs in our, requited love songs in our catalogue. And that's all it is. It's just a simple love song. I was trying to see if I could write one.
I don't need to list achievements. I just know them when I look across the room. And I hope
did.
And you did it.
I also got really into the... I wanted to make a song about winning, like, awards. I got really into the concept of, like, awards shows and ceremonies for a while. The idea that you can win, like, an award for being a like, regular boyfriend is just funny to me. But I'll give you space, my kiss your face. If we had to have some kind of band ethos for Good Morning, it would just be that life is messy and it's never one way or the other. It's never great. It's never bad. It's always everything. And I think that's like what our music tries to bring across. Life is messy and that's good. Once you know what I got to say.
That was the band Good Morning, and that piece was produced by The Frame's intern, Paul Ratliff. I'm John Horn, and you're listening to The Frame Weekend. This week, I was in New York covering new shows on Broadway. I saw the musicals Moulin Rouge, adapted from the Baz Luhrmann film, and Jagged Little Pill, which features songs from Alanis Morissette's smash 1995 album. But there's a production of Swan Lake in L.A. right now by the British choreographer Matthew Bourne that I can't get out of my head, even with all that theater. Somehow, despite the lack of dialogue, his Swan Lake dancers convey all the emotion of a play.
I found a much easier way to express myself was through movement. I went through a period where speaking wasn't... all I do now is speak, of course. But it wasn't my favourite thing. And I took refuge in dance, really. It's intrigued me all through these years of how you can tell a story through movement.
Matthew Bourne's Swan Lake is best known for replacing traditional ballerinas with muscular male swans. It debuted in 1995 in London, and 2 years later, it came to Los Angeles in Bourne's first show outside of the United Kingdom.
The first date here in LA was a gamble, actually. We'd never been abroad before. Gordon Davidson was running the Armisen at that time. He took a risk in bringing over a ballet to fill one of his subscription slots. I think he told his subscription people that if they didn't like it, they could have their money back. But it's still one of the most joyous times, really, is when we came to LA that first time. We were so embraced by the city, it felt. And it felt that way last night again, actually, I must say. The LA audience is the best audience for this show and always has been.
I was talking to a colleague today about Swan Lake, and I said, the actor who plays the dancer, and it was one of those slips that I thought was in some ways the best compliment, because I really... like a lot of people see this as a story as much as a dance. And I'm wondering, historically, what has the story been of Swan Lake? Where does it start narratively as a piece of ballet? What is the story that has been told, and where do you start with your interpretation of that story?
It's actually not enormously different. There's still a queen. There's no king for some reason. You never know why. The mother and son relationship is the same. She's trying to marry him off to a suitable princess. We follow the story that was originally told quite strongly, but of course we deviate from it with the change of sex of the swans. And that creates a psychological difference in the story. It's not about a love story quite so much. It's more a psychological battle between a good voice and a bad voice in the prince's mind, i.e. the white swan and the black swan. That's the way it became once we changed the sex, because it was easier to reflect that.
If I were to line up the 97 production and the current production, I'm sure there are differences. There are some modern touches you add. But in terms of narrative, in terms of story, in terms of things that are gone, things that are emphasized, how would you describe the evolution of the story?
Well, the story has remained more or less the same. And the reason we're still doing it is it's got a classic structure and a classic message. And it really is about a lonely person who wants to be loved. That's the simple story of the piece, in a way. It's about someone who is can't be the person they want to be and the person they are. And I think that's the key to the success of it, is the universality of this, of the nature of the center of the story, rather than all the things that are sort of were controversial originally, men dancing with men, male swans, all those things, royal scandal. And I realized that the audience for the show was quite different. The power that it used to have to shock people, where we had walkouts, is just not the case anymore. the relationship between a prince and a male swan, or whatever you where you see the story, or whatever you think is going on in the prince's mind, people don't find that such a shocker these days. And it's become like a Christmas family show back home in the UK. You bring the kids, you know.
I think that is revolutionary, that what was so out of the ordinary would cause walkouts 20 years ago is now something that people take their families to. Yeah. I was sitting behind an 8-year-old boy last night.
Yeah, and they love it, you know, and it's... I think, but that's why I have asked myself those questions. Why is it still around? If without the shock value... does it still work? You know, and I think it's because it's a very universal, simple message at the center of it.
We're talking with Matthew Bourne, the choreographer of Swan Lake. I'm a sports fan, and I follow kind of the evolution of sports. And it got me thinking about the dancers and about their athleticism and about what dancers can do today that maybe they couldn't have done 20 years ago. Mm-hmm. And it's hard probably for you to have that perspective because you're with them. But in terms of what not just your company, but dancers can accomplish now. Yeah. Are you able to step back and say that's unbelievable?
They are amazing now. But the interesting thing about this production is because it's 20-something years on, a lot of them were not alive when I made it. So I'm now like this sort of historical figure that walks amongst them, you know. But the thing is, they grew up being inspired by this piece, and they're passionate about it. It's their dream to be in it. And you can't buy that kind of dedication from anyone. So they're living the dream. So you've got that added thing as well going on.
Isn't the last scene in Billy Elliot, when Billy Elliot grows up, mm-hmm. isn't he in a Matthew Bourne show?
Yeah, he becomes the swan in our Swan Lake. He's our fictional company member, I will say, Billy Elliot.
Yeah, but he does okay. Matthew Bourne is the director and choreographer of Swan Lake. Matthew, it's great to see you. Thanks for coming.
You too.
In.
Thank you.
Matthew Bourne's Swan Lake is on stage at the Amundsen Theater in downtown LA through January 5th. Coming up, famed public radio host Jad Abumrad wants Dolly Parton to get her due. Making the podcast Dolly Parton's America is up next on The Frame Weekend. Stay with us. This is The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. I grew up poor and ragged. Of course, you know Dolly Parton as a singer and actor, but she's also a prolific songwriter who's written nearly 3,000 songs in her more than 50 years of making music. And not only that, as Dolly has grown older, her fans have grown younger and more diverse. The new podcast, Dolly Parton's America, tries to understand the unifying force behind the Backwoods Barbie. I'm just a backwoods Barbie, too much
makeup, too much hair. I grew up with a very narrow image of Dolly Parton, which was itself attached to a very narrow image of the South and the place where I grew up.
Jad Abumrad is the host. You might know him from WNYC's Radiolab.
You know, I grew up in Nashville. I moved there when I was 5, and then till I was 18. And it was not the Nashville of now. The Nashville of now is this hipster wonderland that is like the southern Brooklyn, right? But at the time when I was there, it was not that. It was a kind of like moderately big city that was definitely wrapped in southern culture. And so as a Lebanese kid, I didn't like feel that welcome there. I mean, it was fine. There's nothing sort of like nothing overtly terrible about it. But, you know, Gulf War I wasn't exactly the funnest of moments. And so I left Nashville with a certain narrative in my mind about that place and what that place was and what it meant to me. And one of the background motivations for me in doing this series was to go back to Nashville and actually like look at it in a more truthful way. I wanted to understand the diversity of Nashville better. And, you know, Dolly Parton seemed like just, as she is with so many things and so many issues and so many communities, an amazing way to look at that.
And it's worth noting, too, that were it not for your father treating a certain car accident injury, this podcast might not have happened. Is that right?
That's exactly right. I mean, 2013, Dolly is with her manager, I believe, and her friend Judy Ogle. And they're in a big black SUV. They get into a minor car accident. She's taken to Vanderbilt Hospital, and my dad happened to be on call that day. He's a doctor, and he ended up giving her some medical advice. I think maybe he met with her one or two more times as doctor-patient, and then they just kind of quickly transitioned to being pals. Independent of that, I became interested in Dolly in 2016 during the election, during sort of right at the very moment where Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton were just like in an all-out brawl. And at that very moment, Dolly comes to Queens and does a stadium show.
My first million selling record.
And I remember how thrilled everybody was around me to go to that show. And the descriptions that they had when they came back from that show were really interesting to me. They were describing this space where every different kind of American was present. It was like a multiracial audience, a multi-ethnic audience. You had people of faith standing next to men in drag, standing next to guys in trucker hats, standing next to hipsters in their like t-shirts or whatever. Like it was all of these different like little slices of America jammed together, and everybody was polite, everyone was getting along, and everybody was singing to the same song. And it was just a really stark juxtaposition to hear those descriptions while watching, you know, like presidential debates.
We're talking with Jad Abumrad about his podcast, Dolly Parton's America. It feels like the subtitle of this podcast could be challenging assumptions. And it's a lot of assumptions that you have about who Dolly Parton is and what her music means. And I'm wondering, as you're reporting this and spending time with her, what were the things that you assumed to be true that you were really, I guess, wrong about?
You know, like I knew the song Jolene, I knew the song 9 to 5, but mostly what I knew of her is that she would go on like late night TV and like she was hilarious, and they would kind of like David Letterman would like joke about her breasts and then she would joke about her breasts.
The last time I was here, I remember the last time I brought my melons to the Big Apple.
She was like a larger than life persona, like larger than life physique. Like that was kind of what I knew of her. That was sort of my starting point. But then when I actually sat down with her and we went kind of album by album through her discography, like the first thing that hits you is, oh my God, she has written a lot of music. Like, oh my God, going back to 1966, 67, she was writing songs back then, and those songs are nothing like 9 to 5. Those songs are worlds of pain.
Daddy, I feel that I must talk to you. Are you sure this is what...
She was like this journalist almost, documenting the pain in the lives of the women around her.
For us kids that I beg you to stay. Please don't just walk out on mama this way.
So like that was it. And then also just when you sort of pan out, you realize this is one of the great songwriters of our era. This is somebody who deserves to be put on par with Bob Dylan. I would even put her on par with Mozart, just in terms of her output, like the number of songs that she's written for as long as she's written them. She's a master of the simple sentiment that is actually not so simple when you stare at it for more than a second. But I also think about, you know, a song like Mule Skinner Blues.
Well, good
I think about her voice on that song. I mean, it's got one of the most fiery rhythm sections of all time. And then you hear her voice on top of it, kind of doing this like angelic sort of yodeling. And I think about just about the beauty of her singing.
Jad Abumrad's podcast is called Dolly Parton's America. Jad, thanks so much for coming on the show.
Hey, thank you so much for having me.
Dolly Parton's America is available from your favorite podcast provider. It's The Frame Weekend. I'm John Horn. When I Love Lucy hit TV in the early 1950s, it was the first primetime comedy produced in front of a live studio audience on the West Coast. Now, a bronze plaque hangs outside the Lucy stage at the Sunset Las Palmas studio. It's one of three lots that make up what are known as Sunset Studios. Frame contributor Marcos Najara reports on the production studio's history and its future.
Once upon a time, four brothers bought a piece of dusty farmland on Sunset Boulevard. Their last name was Warner, and the year was 1919. The brothers Warner built a studio and started making movies, but it wasn't long before they packed up and moved to Burbank. Well, we're moving on up, we're moving on up. And what they left behind were buildings and land that helped start a storytelling boom. Took a whole lot of trying just to get up that hill. From classic TV hits like The Jeffersons and Gunsmoke to more modern fare like Jeopardy and Judge Judy.
What? There's only one person here that has attitude.
Even KTLA's nightly newscast.
Tonight, before we go live, be the first to know the big story.
As well as the film that would change the town forever, the 1927 movie, The Jazz Singer.
Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
Up on a silver screen, Al Jolson sang with a black face. But perhaps even more surprising for the audience was not just what they saw, but what they heard.
Nothing but blue skies from now on.
For the first time in forever, people watching a movie could listen too. This was Hollywood's first feature-length talking film, and it was shot at Sunset Studios.
Now get this. Blue skies, smiling at me.
I feel like the Hollywood gods are and the goddesses are there in spirit.
That is writer Norma P. Sepulveda.
And it's just a wonderful experience to get a little bit of the old with like this supercharged new reality.
These days, she comes to the lot at Sunset Studios to pitch projects to Netflix, who moved into their new shiny headquarters here just 2 years ago.
I feel like those turnstiles are like the gate to the creative heaven. You know what I mean? It's like you're watching people going in and out, and you're going to be one of those people in any second now going up, you know, to the portal of creativity to heaven. And you might walk out of there, you know, with a huge smile on your face, you know, that you sold something, or, you know, you might be getting called back again, or thanks, but no thanks. But still, you've gotten your shot, which is so cool.
As a little girl growing up here in Southern California, she watched all the TV shows, cartoons, and movies that came out of Sunset Studios.
Those are the stories I'm passionate about. Those are the stories I want to make.
When creative talent comes in and they know this history.
Bill Humphrey is Senior Vice President for Sunset Studios. Together, the three lots, Sunset Bronson, Sunset Gower, and Sunset Las Palmas, have 37 high-tech sound stages on ground spanning more than 40 acres. The Sunset Bronson lot, where I'm talking with Humphrey, is marked by KTLA's original 1925 radio tower, proudly standing guard.
If you walk down the hall here, we're now in the mansion of the old Warner Brothers headquarters, which is now part of our Netflix complex. Down at the end, you'll see these three circles in the ceiling, which was the executive house of Jack Warner. Looney Tunes. Bugs Bunny coming through the three circles. He looked up and goes, let's use that as a symbol for Looney Tunes.
So that became the logo.
The mansion, this was the original Warner Brothers headquarters. And Jack Warner's brother supposedly didn't like it so much. So this is about the length of a football field. So they had offices on either end. So they never interact with each other. But they still made movies. Also back then, they were the first company to bring radio to the West Coast.
Continued innovation, says Humphrey, means keeping up with changing needs. That usually means plenty of space for people to work, think, and create. New buildings have already gone up here for Technicolor and Netflix, and another creative tower is set to open next year. The goal is to bring different production departments closer together to actual production facilities.
I always call it sort of the media tech intersection. Technology people and media people and creative people all can work together toward this goal of creating great product for global distribution very rapidly.
But this fast factory model does have its critics.
I'd prefer a diverse media environment.
Emerson College professor Jane Shattuck is currently writing a book about Netflix.
There is fear in global theory that we are turning out this American product, but it's not only American, it's this kind of generalized global product that we're, you know, this kind of, if people can have an IKEA apartment, you know, with the and look exactly like their neighbor.
But in the end, who are we to judge how these next 100 years should play out for Sunset Studios? Perhaps no one really should. That is, unless
you are about to enter the courtroom of Judge Judith Scheindlin.
For The Frame, I'm Marcos Najera.
That will do it for this week. The Frame Weekend is edited by Darby Maloney and produced by her, Monica Bushman, Jonathan Shiflett, and Julia Paskin, with help this week from Itzy Quintanilla. Eduardo Perez is our engineer. Andrea Gutierrez is our news clerk. And our intern is Paul Ratliff. We say goodbye and thank him for his great work. The Frame's theme music is by Taylor McFerrin, and the show's senior producer is Oscar Garza. I'm John Horn from the Moen Broadcast Center at KPCC. We'll be back here on Monday for the daily version of The Frame. We'll see you then.